You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time once again for From the Bookshelf. Harlow Giles Unger returns to the show this week. He's an historian who has written many fine books on our founding fathers and early American history, and makes those books feel like current events. His books include Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office, Lion of Liberty, Patrick Henry and the Call to a New Nation, John Quincy Adams, The Last Founding Father, James Monroe and a Nation's Call to Greatness, and his latest book, First Founding Father, Richard Henry Lee and the Call to Independence. Harlow Giles Unger, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. It's very nice of you to invite me.
Yeah, so you've written about every possible founding father, and so now you've just resorted to making one up, right? I mean, there never was anyone named Richard Henry Lee, was there?
Absolutely.
There was?
There are no statues to tear down.
I thought he was just a fictional character like Daniel Boone or Davy Crockett.
No, he actually existed, and he really deserved the title, which he never got until I gave it to him as first founding father. Most people think that Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, and Thomas Jefferson made sure that most Americans thought that by inscribing, writing the inscription for the monument over his tomb that says Thomas Jefferson was the author of the Declaration of Independence. But more than a month before that, on June 7th, 1776, Richard Henry Lee stood in Congress and read the words he had written on a piece of paper to make this resolution that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved. That was the original Declaration of Independence. As I say, it was it was presented on June 7, 1776, and on July 2nd, it was voted on by Congress and approved. So that July 2nd was the actual date of American independence. The newspapers all celebrated it. John Adams who seconded the resolution, by the way. John Adams wrote a quick note to his wife, Abigail, who was up in Massachusetts, saying that July 2nd will be celebrated from now through the rest of time as one of the most important days in the history of our nation and the world. So July 2nd was original Independence Day. But they decided, Congress looked over this short little Declaration of Independence and decided, hey, we're going to be a nation and declare independence. We ought to have something longer than that. So they appointed a committee with Adams and Franklin and Jefferson, who was the youngest of the group, to embellish it, to add some meat to it. And well, the older fellows were kind of tired, and they gave Jefferson the job of doing it. And he wrote the beautiful preamble, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and then the second beautiful second paragraph, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. So that became the official document that was later approved in August by all the states. And that became the official Declaration of Independence. It incorporates, in the last paragraph, the next to the last paragraph, it incorporates the original Declaration written by Richard Henry Lee.
So he copied him. Jefferson copied him.
Well, he didn't. That had to be incorporated because that was the actual resolution for independence. So he had to incorporate that into the Declaration. But as far as copying, he didn't copy, but he plagiarized a lot of parts of it that he wrote. He plagiarized a lot of John Locke's writings on the rights of man and the how you when people have a right to form their own government, which was quite a topic of discussion at the time. At the time, the Western world, all the nations were ruled by monarchs, and until we declared independence, no one had ever tried to overthrow a king, other than the king's relatives.
Right, to be so that they would be king.
Yeah, the people never thought they had a right to declare independence and set up a republic. This was to be the first republican government in world history.
Well, Harlow Giles Unger, how dangerous was it for Richard Henry Lee to propose this?
Well, no more than it was for all the other members of Congress. They actually to declare independence, to reject the king, was treason. So they were all subject to be arrested and hung or drawn and quartered. Either way, it wouldn't be pretty if they were caught. So they were all guilty of treason. Arguably, Richard Henry Lee was first, but all the signers of the Declaration of Independence were committing treason, and many of them hesitated. They were not eager to die, especially since many of them weren't really that convinced that this was the right path to take. There were many, members of Congress and across the states at the time who were reconciliationists. They wanted to reconcile things with matters with Britain. They, in fact, several days before the resolution was accepted on July 2nd, only the previous week. One of the Congress voted, it was called the Olive Branch Resolution that was sent to the king saying, we want you to remain our king, we are your loyal subjects, get Parliament to stop taxing us, and we want to remain part of the British Empire. So there was tremendous sentiment for that. The problem was that the king had nothing to do with taxing us. Parliament did that on its own, and the king could not do anything about it, and so he rejected the Olive Branch petition, and the Declaration of Independence that Richard Henry Lee wrote was approved by Congress on July 2nd.
So why has so little been written about this remarkable man?
Well, Richard Henry Lee's Virginia mansion was on a cliff in an isolated area of the Northern Neck, which is one of those peninsulas that stick out into the Potomac River. It was far, far from the nearest town, and it wasn't the kind of mansion where leaders of the day used to visit. People visited Mount Vernon, which was 10 miles from Alexandria. So Richard Henry Lee's home was far from any place that ordinary people could come to see. So when he died, his wife and two children moved to Alexandria and let the mansion kind of run down. It did, and eventually some gunfire by a British ship, passing British warship, set it afire. It burned to the ground. There's not a trace of that mansion left. So there's no place to visit, whereas you can visit Monticello. The heirs to the Jefferson family kept that going, and it's a national monument. Same thing with Mount Vernon. The ladies of Mount Vernon have kept Mount Vernon, restored Mount Vernon, kept it going. It's now a historic site that's visited by millions each year. So that's one reason. And the second reason is that Jefferson inscribed his tombstone with the father of the Declaration of Independence, which isn't true. But he took credit for it. And then in the 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt seemed to fall in love with Jefferson, and with the Jefferson Memorial Foundation sponsored the construction of the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, so that you drive into Washington from Alexandria. Of course, there's the monument with this gigantic statue of Jefferson inside of it. And as a result, people who visit Washington, they're going to go to the Jefferson Memorial, the Lincoln Memorial, and the Capitol Building. And they can't miss the Washington Memorial.
So not only is there not a statue to tear down, but there really should be.
Probably, I think so.
Well, of course, we know that when America became an independent country and ratified the Constitution a few years later, slavery was part of that country. But I was intrigued to read in your book, First Founding Father Richard Henry Lee and the Call for American Independence, that he was against slavery and believed it should end.
Yes, so did Washington, so did Franklin, so did almost all of the founding fathers. Remember, these were men who grew up on properties where slaves were part of the property. They never bought any slaves. They inherited these properties, and slaves were part of that property. The states had laws. The states were all independent. They were basically independent nations, and they had harsh laws forbidding slave owners to free their slaves. That was reducing the value of the property, and it's as if they burned down the houses. They were forbidden from doing that. They could not, on their own, free their slaves. So that was an impossibility, and they were well aware of it. But people like Washington were all against slavery. They had grown up very, very devout Anglicans in most cases, and in the North about Puritans. But the laws of each state forbade freeing any slaves. So there was nothing they could legally do without going to prison. And the slaves wouldn't be freed anyway. The law would recapture them and put them back on the properties that they owned. And remember, it's not just the Southerners who owned slaves. Slavery was the law across the 13 colonies. People in Massachusetts had slaves. They didn't have as many because the properties were smaller. Most of the slaves in the North were domestic, were used as domestic servants. And cities like Boston were quite advanced, so that slaves had lived the lives of domestic servants today, although they were slaves. They could not do whatever they wanted to. But almost everybody of note, with the exception of Jefferson, did indeed free their slaves under their wills. A will, remember, supersedes the law of any state. If you say I'm freeing my slaves, the law cannot stop you. You're dead. They can't prosecute you, and that becomes the law of the land. So Washington's slaves were all freed after Martha died. 6 years after George died. And many, many plantations in the South did that, with the exception of Jefferson.
he was particularly fond of his slaves, if I recall.
Well, he was fond of Sally Hemings, the 16-year-old that he took with him to Paris, and sired a number of children by her.
And those children were his slaves as well?
Oh, yeah.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with historian Harlow Giles Unger, and his new book is called First Founding Father, Richard Henry Lee and the Call to Independence. Well, you know, you mentioned that there's no statues to tear down of Richard Henry Lee, and that makes me want to ask you about the recent comments of our president, Donald Trump, who said that if we remove statues of Robert E. Lee, would Washington be next? Can you tell us if he's misguided in that particular idea?
Well, if you're going to tear down statues of slave owners, you've got to tear down the statues of almost every founding father including Benjamin Franklin, who owned two slaves and lived in the North. So the whole thing becomes ridiculous. You can't do what the communists did in Russia and wipe out history by tearing down statues, rewriting books. History is a fact of life, and the best thing to do is to learn it in the first place, understand it in the second place, and if you don't like it, don't repeat it.
So do you think they were the people who want to tear down Robert E. Lee's statues are misguided?
They're not only misguided, they're ignorant. They're totally ignorant. He was, in the first place, until several years before the Civil War, and even after the Civil War, most Americans across the nation had very little allegiance to the United States of America. If you ask the average person, where are you from, they would say Virginia. They would say New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania. Nobody would say I'm an American. They had very little allegiance to the federal government. The only reason that the North had more allegiance to the Union was for commercial and economic reasons. They had, by the time of the Civil War, built a huge network of railways and roads that tied together the states in ways that the South had not yet done. The South was still an agricultural society, pretty well separated from each state from the other, with backward roads. Transportation was very, very difficult, and commerce was very difficult. The network of railways and roads and canals that the states in the North built to tie commerce together tied each of the states together in ways they didn't even know they were being tied together. But suddenly, buyers in Ohio were buying goods from suppliers in New York. And so they were being tied in commercial ways. Friends, relatives were able to go and visit their children who moved out west. Prior to that, when you moved out, because farms were so small in the Northeast, the second or third son, there was no land for him to inherit. He'd go move out west, and that would be the last they'd ever see each other because travel was so difficult in the early days of the colonies. By the time of the Civil War, in the mid 1840s and mid 1860s. 1850s, this network of roads and railways and canals allowed people to travel so they could visit each other. A boy from Pennsylvania could marry a girl from Ohio, and their families would visit each other. So ties were being established that created more cohesion in the North, and more allegiance to the Union, because they saw what the South wanted. The idea of secession would have bankrupted the North. It would not have bankrupted the South because the states down there were still independent, basically independent little nations of their own, each doing business in different ways. Virginia sold a lot of tobacco to England. South Carolina sold a lot of rice. Cotton was becoming a fairly big crop in the South. So that each of these states of the South had a separate economy. They weren't tied to each other as much as they were tied to outside buyers.
So you're saying that Robert E. Lee...
Well, he was a commandant of West Point. He was a great patriot, a great soldier for the North. But in the end, his allegiance was more to Virginia than it was to the Union, which was quite normal in the South.
Well, what about people who say that these statues of Robert E. Lee that were in question were put up not back in the days of Robert E. Lee or the Civil War, but put up during the 1950s by Jim Crow law supporters?
Well, I'm sure some. I'm not sure all of them were. I don't know about the one in Charlottesville, actually. After the war, he he became a very loyal American, helped found a college, Washington and Lee University, what good does it do to obscure history? It accomplishes nothing except promote ignorance. You don't learn about slavery. You don't learn about Robert E. Lee. You don't learn about that period of American history, which was a very complex period in our history, a period so complex that if you don't understand it, you have great difficulty understanding current events, because many of the problems they faced in those in the days before the Civil War, we are still facing today. And like it or not, you can tear down all the statues of slave owners. You're not going to affect the plight of African Americans in this country today. You're not going to change the fact that they are that the nation as a whole, the individual states, state governments, deprive African American children of the same education that they give white children, deprive them of the same kind of housing and living conditions that they give white people. So tear down all the statues. That's not going to do any good. Go and tear down some of the public schools in the slums. Go and feed those children. Stop wasting energy on stupid things like tearing down statues. Do something for your country rather than tear down statues.
Well, tell me, what you've written so many wonderful books, and I think they're great, but tell me, what are the lessons from your books that modern readers or modern politicians could draw from?
Well, there's a difference between the politicians and the readers. I guess there's an overlap there, but one unfortunate thing that has happened is because of the decline in the quality of education in America, people do not bother to vote anymore. And the net result is that most state capitals have been infiltrated by out-and-out crooks. Becoming a politician is almost a license to steal. I've forgotten how many governors of Illinois have gone to jail recently. New Jersey has a corrupt government. California is under siege right now because of corruption in its government. The New York State Senate and Assembly, they give each other as much money as they want. They vote things that they call lulus. And it's a bonus at the end of the year. They give each assemblyman and senator just for breathing the air. It's just stealing public money. And that's what's going on in government across the nation, because no one's bothering to vote. You're lucky if you get a quarter of the electorate bothering to vote in state elections. Even in presidential elections, if you get 50%, that's huge. So no one's bothering to vote.
Well, you know, one of the sentiments that helped get Donald Trump elected was this idea that politicians are crooks and we should get somebody who's not a politician in office.
No, I don't think so. I think they voted for Trump because of out-and-out ignorance about how government should work, can work. Again, you didn't get 50% of the people voting. So you got and the election was manipulated in a way that a minority voted, put the president in power. That's not the way our system is supposed to work. That's the result of manipulators and sheer ignorance on the part of voters. They have no idea what they're voting for. They don't understand how government works, and they think that simple solutions are the answer to complex problems, and they're not. In fact, some complex problems have no solution.
Well, what about the Electoral College that your founding fathers put in place? Are you a fan, or do you think it's time for it to go?
Well, it's probably time for it to go, but it's not going to go. The nation has grown to such a huge population that holding a constitutional convention, which you have to do, is virtually impossible now. I don't think it'll be possible. The answer to the nation's problems. And this is what the founding fathers believed. The answer is education. And I mean, when years ago there was a required course in every elementary, middle, junior high school, and high school called civics, in which the kids spent a whole year learning how government works, how they can participate as citizens, and now that's now you have home economics instead of civics, and that's ridiculous. That teaches children nothing. And the net result is that most people don't bother to vote. They don't care. They really are self-centered and are most interested in what goes on around their house, their neighborhood, and their little village, and not about the nation, because they don't. The problems the nation faces are so complex that it's very difficult to understand, even with a decent high school education. Without it, it's impossible to understand.
Do you think the founding fathers benefited from not having Twitter feeds?
One of the things about the founding fathers is you have to understand they did not really believe in a full-fledged democracy. In fact, they hated the word democracy. They believed in a republican form of government, and they believed in free enterprise gone wild. their real motive in declaring independence, and they were very reluctant in doing so, the real motive in declaring independence was not to provide to make all men equal. Their real motive was to prevent Britain from taxing them. They had complete controls of their properties and their businesses at the time. They were the richest men in America. They controlled their lands and their properties, and no one else had anything to say in it. And after the revolution was over, no one got the vote. Only people with property could vote. Slaves were still slaves. Women were still chattel. And if you didn't own any property, you had no say in government. So nothing really had changed except Britain couldn't tax us anymore. But then what happened, of course, without Britain supplying the funds raised from taxes, without supplying the funds to run local governments, the state governments started going bankrupt, and they had to impose taxes, and soon you had riots going on across the country. In Massachusetts, they burned down courthouses in I don't know how many towns to prevent the state from collecting taxes. They burned down courthouses in Virginia, in Georgia, all across the nation there were riots, and that's when the founding fathers or their successors got together and said, we need a central government to put these riots down. And they held a constitutional convention and created a strong federal government that could raise the taxes.
So Americans have never wanted to pay taxes. They still don't want to pay taxes.
No. They somehow think government can run without paying for it.
And if you want a solid education, if you want citizens to be educated. I mean, if you want to live in a world where people are educated, you must pay taxes, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You have to have decent schools, and you have to start. The two elements of social and political care in this country that should be the most important priorities are health and education. And they are on our bottom. They are at the bottom of our list of priorities. We spend less on education and health than any other civilized nation on Earth. We just don't care. And the net result is eventually we're going to lose our democracy. We're going to fall into some sort of totalitarian government.
What can we do to prevent that? I'd like to prevent that, and I want you to
like
tell
to
me
prevent
how.
It. Well, we have to focus first on education and get our public schools up to snuff and start teaching children how to be good citizens. And they can't do it without being able to speak, read, and write the language properly. And they can't do it without understanding our history. And they can't do it without understanding how government operates and how to govern themselves. Each class, when I was a child, each elementary school class would hold elections every year for the class president and everything. The president didn't have any power, of course, but it was symbolic. And we learned how government functioned, what a treasurer does, what a Secretary of State does, what a President does. And little by little, you keep doing this over 12 years of education, you graduate knowing how your local government works, how your state government works, and how your federal government works. And you can vote intelligently.
This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we're talking tonight with Harlow Giles Unger. His new book is called First Founding Father, Richard Henry Lee, and the Call to Independence. Well, I feel there's a catch-22 here, because you were just saying how politicians are corrupt, and therefore people don't want to pay taxes because they believe their corrupt politicians are making off with their taxes and using them for their own personal gain. But if we don't pay taxes, we won't get a good education, and then we won't have this educated population.
Well, you have to start somewhere, and you have to start electing candidates for their... not what they can do for you personally, but what they can do for your community, your state, and your nation. You have to start. You have to stop being selfish when you vote. You have to think much more globally, in a sense, and start electing. There are decent men and women running for office, and often they are rejected in favor of pie-in-the-sky promises by people who later are shown to be crooks. I mean, it can't be a coincidence that I've forgotten whether it's three or four successive governors of Illinois go to jail. I mean, it can't be coincidence that there's a major city in Connecticut, Waterbury, Connecticut, where four successive mayors went to jail, and the last one, while in jail, was reelected.
Can you serve when you're in jail? Is that legal?
I guess in Connecticut it was, or in Waterbury, Connecticut it was. I mean, it's obscene. What kind of people are there in a community that would do that? I mean, they're either just totally ignorant, or they're all on the take somehow.
Do you have a feeling, a prediction of where we're going to go in our current administration?
No, I think we're heading towards a totalitarian regime, but. Fortunately, we have elections frequently enough that we'll probably be able to head that off. But I'm worried that this was a granted a minority president, but he still was elected by the American people, and to me, it shows a great lack of knowledge by an awful lot of people, an awful lot of voters, to elect a man who seems to have so little knowledge of American history and American government and the Constitution, especially.
Well, if you could get President Trump to read a book, what book should he read?
I don't think he'd understand it, but I would start with Thomas Paine's Common Sense, And then The Rights of Man, also by Thomas Paine. And perhaps Rousseau's Social Contract, and some Montesquieu, and some John Locke.
Did those come in Classics Illustrated version, Harlow Johnson?
They did come in Classic Comics, I think, at one point. But no, it's a shame that he doesn't have a complete education in terms of history and literature and art. He doesn't have the kind of background that an executive, even an executive in big business, should have to administer a large enterprise.
But fortunately, he surrounded himself with the best and the brightest.
Well, I would disagree with that. I don't think they are the best and the brightest. Certainly this Secretary the Interior seems to want to roll back all the national monuments and even the national parks. Head of the EPA is not renewing the contracts of academicians charged with supervising policy of the Environmental Protection Agency, and he's replacing them with people from the industry. So they're taking dangerous steps that seem to favor private industry more than the American people and the nation.
Following in the steps of our founding fathers.
Well, yes and no. The founding fathers were arch capitalists of their era, but they did learn a great deal that they did better as capitalists. They sold more tobacco, or sold more cotton, or sold more timber, if they learned the ins and outs of international trade, if they made friends with friendly nations rather than antagonize them, and if they encouraged education of the young and protection of the environment. They didn't know much about health care. Healthcare was really something, it was in the hands of God. You just died of most diseases, and it was a shame. And that's why they, most families had, would have, you know, 8-10 children, because the infant mortality rate was so high. In many cases, they were lucky if they had two surviving children who reached adulthood. One of the amazing feats in terms of child raising was Patrick Henry, who had 22 children, and they all survived.
Oh,
and yes, his friends in Virginia said that he, not Washington, was the real father of our country. But that was an amazing, by two wives. His first wife died after giving birth, I think, to 8 or 10 of the children. I think eight children. And then the second wife gave birth to the next 14. Amazingly, they all survived.
In those days, you were better off if the doctor didn't come around. I mean, didn't the doctors hasten General Washington's death?
Arguably so. The standard treatment, this was almost universal, standard treatment was bleeding and purging. The theory was that if you've got a disease inside of you, clean out the insides. So they gave very strong emetics to force to clean out the intestines and the gut, and they would bleed you to let whatever is in your blood, let that the disease flow out with the blood, and that was That was just accepted medical treatment in those days. The idea of blood transfusion, putting fresh blood in rather than taking the old blood out, didn't occur to anybody. The first effort in that direction was in around 1818, so it was much after our Revolutionary War, and it didn't work. Every effort to transfuse blood, first of all, it had to be done with knives and little rubber pumps that they had. They would try to get the blood into the other person's body. The hollow needle that we now use for injections, the hollow needle wasn't invented until mid-19th century. And when they first started giving blood, transfusing it, they had to do it with a needle, a syringe. And it would take hours and hours and hours to transfuse just a little bit of blood. And most people would die anyway because they didn't discover blood types until 1898. That was a fellow named Karl Landsteiner, who won the Nobel Prize. And then even with the blood types, you still had a 10 to 20% mortality rate from blood transfusions until they discovered the Rh factor in the 1930s, 1936. Again, Landsteiner. So the idea of transfusing blood was just impossible. You didn't have the tools to do it with. The idea, which sounded very, very logical, and that idea goes back to Hippocrates in ancient Greece, that there are four elements to the blood, and if one of them gets a disease in you, you've got to get the blood out of you. And so Washington was bled, and he wasn't feeling any better. He demanded that his doctor keep bleeding until he felt better. Well, he died, and must have probably felt better afterwards.
Well,
and,
yes.
It was Richard Henry Lee's great nephew, in other words, cousin once removed. It was his cousin's son, Light Horse Harry Lee, who was quite a hero in the Revolutionary War, who gave the eulogy for Washington, that Washington was first in war, first in peace, first in the hearts of his countrymen. And Light Horse Harry Lee's, one of his sons, was Robert E. Lee. And the irony of Robert E. Lee is that most Americans all remember Robert E. Lee, who led the war to break the Union up, and few people remember Richard Henry Lee, who fought the war to put the Union together.
Well, as usual, Harlow Giles Unger, I've made you talk about everything but your book, Richard Henry Lee, First Founding Father, and the call for American independence. But what are you going to write next? Do you have another book on tap?
Yeah, I have two on tap. The story of Benjamin Rush, another of our founding fathers. He was the only MD, the only doctor to sign the Declaration of Independence, and he was the champion of bleed and purge. and the last great practitioner of it. And then the next one coming out in 2 years is the biography of Thomas Paine.
Well, this book is called First Founding Father, Richard Henry Lee and the Call for American Independence. And the author, my guest, the brilliant Harlow Giles Unger, thank you so much for spending some time with me on From the Bookshelf.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. You can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Harlow Giles Unger. His latest book, First Founding Father, Richard Henry Lee and the Call to Independence. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we'll see you next time.